Breaking news coming in from Bet365, and it's no surprise. Same game parlay from Bet365 just keeps getting better.
Well, it's even easier to make a bet. Choose from the most popular markets, like hits, run line, totals, and home runs. So many to choose from.
Download the app, start building your bet, and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
You're listening to the Common Fan Podcast, a Husker football podcast for the common fan by the common fan.
Welcome back to the Common Fan Podcast. I am TJ Burkle, as always, alongside Matty Owen Sr. and Geoff in Lincoln. Hey, get to the Common Fan website, www.commonfan.co. Sign up for the free newsletter, subscribe on YouTube, follow all the social media accounts, and generally keep up with all the fun and frivolity of the Common Fans. Football season is right around the corner, and you don't want to miss out on all the Common Fan activities. So go to commonfan.co and check out everything that's there. You can also get your Common Fan socks. You can get them in time for football season. Go to sillesco.com, sillesco.com, and use the promo code, GBR for life. That's GBR number 4LIFE, and get 25% off. And the great thing there, guys, is they don't just sell Common Fan socks. They sell all kinds of socks on the Sillies website. And that promo code will get you 25% off any pair of socks on the Sillies website. So go to sillesco.com, use the promo code GBR for life. All right. Very excited to kick this off, gentlemen. Part of our promise here at the Common Fan Podcast is that we are focused on all Husker football all the time. We're here to help you get through the highs, the lows, and especially the slow times when the rest of the world is focused on other things, but we're still obsessing over our beloved Big Red. Last summer, the Common Fans brought you The Reckoning, a series of 6 episodes focused on each of Nebraska football coaches, since Tom Osborne retired. Today, we're excited to launch a new series, T.O., focused on the coaching career of the one and only Tom Osborne. Coach Osborne is the most important and consequential coach in the history of Nebraska football and one of the greatest ever to walk a sideline. As the offensive coordinator for Nebraska's first 2 national championship teams and the head coach for the other 3, no one played a more central role in the most consequential moments, games, and seasons of Nebraska's illustrious gridiron history. Today's episode, The Fateful Promotion, is focused on T.O.'s time as an assistant to Bob Devaney from 1962 through 1972, during which the young coach worked his way up from a graduate assistant to Nebraska's offensive coordinator before ultimately being hired as head coach. Joining us today are Henry Cordes, an Omaha World Herald reporter and author of multiple books, including Devaney, Birth of a Dynasty, and Unbeatable, Tom Osborne and the Greatest Era of Nebraska Football. Those are 2 must-haves for all Common Fans. I highly recommend. I've got them sitting right here on my desk in my office. Also joining us is Brandon Vogel from the Counter Read newsletter. Some of the best Husker content out there. Brandon's been on with us many times. One of the most knowledgeable guys out there. Really unique perspective on Husker football. Check out counterread.com for all his great work. Gentlemen, it's great to have you join the Common Fans today.
Yeah, I'm really glad to be here. This is my first appearance, and I can tell you I'm as someone who has a dog who likes to walk a lot, I'm a consumer of a lot of Husker podcasts, and we know there's a lot of them out there, but you guys have been a great addition to that whole genre, and you have your own niche, and the series you did on the coaches was tremendous. So I'm really glad to be here.
Thank you,
Henry. Thank you so much.
High praise. Love it. Thank you.
Brandon, how are
Thanks
you?
Thanks for having me. I'm well. Thanks for having me back, guys. And congrats. I was happy to be part of that series last year. And I think this is as good idea of, hey, let's take something, explode the moment, really dig into it, and give people something when, you know, the news tapers off at least a little bit, although I don't know if that happens at all in today's college football.
Yeah, you just never know. We're recording all these episodes in advance, so who knows what's going to be going on in June and July. It's every time we think it's going to be slow, something breaks, right? I don't know. But hey, let's jump right in. Let's start at the beginning, shall we? So this is not a biography of Tom Osborne's life. It's a deep dive into his coaching career, but I want to set the stage a little bit. So Bob Devaney takes over as Nebraska's head coach in early 1962. In the 21 seasons prior to Devaney's arrival, the Huskers had only three winning seasons. From 1941 to 1961, Nebraska football had zero championships and only went to one bowl game. And that was only because Oklahoma wasn't eligible and Nebraska went as the conference runner-up. So Devaney takes over in early 1962. Tom Osborne, meanwhile, played football at Hastings College. He actually had an offer to the University of Nebraska, but his father and grandfather had played at Hastings. So he played football at Hastings College in the mid to late 1950s. He had a few years in the NFL, and then he ends up on Nebraska's campus as a graduate student studying educational psychology. When did that happen, might you ask? January of 1962, right around the time Bob Devaney was moving into the football office. If I don't know if you need any evidence that God's a Cornhusker, but that's a strong data point right there. So while it was a student, Coach Osborne couldn't quite let go of the football bug. So Henry, let's start with you. Can you kind of tell us a story of how he ended up on Bob Devaney's staff? You know, it's a guy who's getting his PhD, probably got his sights going in a few different directions at a young age, but clearly didn't want to walk away from the game yet. So how did that come about?
Yeah, I've had that conversation with Tom, and yeah, what happened was, you know, he did play a couple of years in the NFL, but you know, life on the fringe of the NFL, as we know, is kind of rough, and he had some injury issues, and he had a dispute with the Redskins. You know, just kind of shows you how different the NFL was then. He felt they owed him $500 because they hadn't paid him for the exhibition games that he'd played in the previous year, And so with all that going on, he finally just decided that he was going to hang it up. And he enrolled in the University of Nebraska with plans to get a doctorate in educational, you know, psychology. This is where Dr. Tom came from. But he was not quite ready to give up football. And as you pointed out, his arrival pretty much corresponded with Devaney. So he wrote Devaney a letter and wouldn't. Anybody love to see that letter if it still exists in an archive somewhere, but he wrote him a letter just asking for a position on his staff. Well, Devaney had already filled. He said, well, I don't have any graduate assistant jobs, but they had a problem over at Selleck Quadrangle, one of the dorms where a lot of the football players live. Some kind of ruffian players had kind of taken over part of the dorm and were kind of out of control. And so Devaney said to Tom, well, if you move into Selleck and get these guys under control, I'll let you eat at our training table. And that was just the original deal. And Tom accepted it. It wasn't even a coaching position at that point. But Tom moved in and he broke up some fights and got it under control. And that was his relationship with Devaney. But then by the fall of 1962, as football season was getting going, he actually had a graduate assistant position there.
That's amazing. Brandon, anything to add to that?
No, I mean, to your point of God being a Cornhusker to the kind of sliding doors part of that, you know, Osborne's, I think, best NFL season was his last one. You know, he didn't really play much at all. In his rookie season, got a couple of catches in his second year. And then he was kind of a starter in his final season with the Redskins. And if not for that dispute, you know, just kind of the way things worked out, he's probably not on campus, you know, that January. It was a very different time in the NFL, of course, too, as Henry noted, but just kind of adds a little bit, I think, to the fatefulness of how things transpired.
Yeah. I mean, that's so crazy. You just think of those, you know, those situations in life where it's one letter or one letter written or one introduction or one thing that happens that sets the course for, you know, 40 some years of history. for Nebraska football. Henriette, as a grad assistant, what was T.O.'s role? What was Coach Osborne's role as a grad assistant? I'm guessing he wasn't, you know, drawing, you know, option plays up in the sand quite yet. You know, that's came down the road. But what was he doing at that point?
Yeah, as I recall, he was kind of helping out with the receivers. And in fact, when he joined the regular staff, that's kind of what he did as well. But Devaney has said that he recognized the genius of Osborne pretty early on. And he's even said that by 1964, he was wondering whether this guy was even a potential successor for him. But so I don't think he played a huge role. I mean, Devaney brought most of his staff with him from Wyoming, mm-hmm. and they had tremendous success in Wyoming. And frankly, they came into Lincoln and they had tremendous success from day one. I mean, they pasted University of South Dakota in the first game, and then his second game, you know, they're coming off a 3-6-1 season the previous year, and they go into Michigan in the Big House, and they upset Michigan in Bob Devaney's second game as coach. And you have to also remember, before he went to Wyoming, he had been at the staff of Michigan State, and Duffy Doherty, who was probably a bigger rivalry of Michigan at the time than even Ohio State was. So you can imagine how satisfying that was for him to go at his second game and first road game as a Husker coach to go into the Big House and win. And they shared the Big Eight championship in Devaney's first year. So I don't think we can say that Tom probably had a huge role in that, because he, like I said, he brought in a pretty, this is Tom's first year ever as a coach.
Right.
And Devaney just had remarkable success almost from the very beginning. They won 4 Big Eight championships, I think, in his first 5 or 6 years, which was exactly 4 more than they had won in the previous 20 years. So it was remarkable the amount of success he had from the beginning. And I'd say was a small part of that.
Sure. Was 62, was that the Gotham Bowl? Was that the year they went to the Gotham Bowl?
That was the year they went to the Gotham Bowl, too, yeah. Which was only, what, the 3rd bowl in school history. And nobody saw it, but apparently it was very exciting. Yeah. Yep. For the shootout with Miami, with all of like 1,000 people in the stands in the snow of New York City.
Yeah, it was fun hearing those stories this last year during bowl season.
Right. Yeah, totally was. Just a backpedal. I love that he was brought in as like the enforcer at the dorms. That's like the best story ever. I envision it more like Patrick Swayze in Roadhouse, just getting brought in to break things up and settle things down. I love it. Just needed some high waisted jeans and some roundhouse kicks. Let's talk about T.O. a little bit here. His book, More Than Winning. A lot of people know T.O. and as TJ said right at the beginning, like, greatest coach Nebraska's ever had, greatest coach to ever walk the sidelines. But I don't think a lot of people, myself included, realized, you know, T.O. was a lot more than that. I mean, he's a smart dude. It sounds like he had some opportunities in higher education. Once he completed his PhD studies, he could have been a teacher. He could have gone into administration. The guy could have done just about anything. How did it, do you think, did it come about that he decided to join Devaney's staff full-time instead of pursuing a career in academia? Because it sounds like he was really good at that too.
Well, that's a conversation I had with him as well. He basically said that, yes, in 65, he had completed his doctorate. You know, so for the first 3 years, he's kind of straddling higher education and football. He is literally teaching classes in the morning as a graduate assistant in the College of Education. And then in the afternoon, he's going and coaching football. And he did that all through that time. And so then he, in 65, 66 kind of area, he kind of had a decision to make, because he was offered a full-time position in the College of Education. And he was very seriously considering taking it. And, but he, again, just could not let go of football. So he went to Devaney and he struck a deal with them. He said, if you can match the $10,000 salary that they offered me to be a college professor here, I'd like to become an assistant, full-time assistant coach on your team? And again, one of those fateful decisions, right? I mean, what if in 97, instead of retiring as football national champion coach of the Cornhuskers, he was instead retiring as the dean of the College of Education at the University of Nebraska? I think that potential
timelines.
I think that potential was actually there.
That's incredible. Brandon, anything to add to that? Go ahead, Jeff.
Well, no, I wasn't aware that he got his salary matched, because as we were talking about this, I was thinking, I was like, well, man, a PhD full professor's got to make way more than like an assistant football coach in his you know, what would have been his, what, third or fourth year. So I think it further speaks to Devaney, and, you know, I have some thoughts about this with, I think, some of the things we'll discuss later, just his foresight of like being willing to do that for Coach Osborne, because he saw something in him.
Yeah. That's incredible. One point, going back to the Gotham Bowl in 1962, you can hear all about that game on the Common Fan episode interview with 1962 co-captain and captain and Gotham Bowl veteran Dwayne Carlson. So go to the YouTube page and find that one. That's from December. Anyway. All right. So Osborne joins the staff full time in 1966. As you noted, Henry, at that point, Devaney's completely turned the program around. Let's tick through it really quick. They go 9-2 in 1962. That's a Gotham Bowl game, third ever bowl game. 10-1 in 1963. They win the Big Eight, win the Orange Bowl. 9-2 in 1964, win the Big Eight. They lost the Cotton Bowl that year. 10-1 in 1965, they win the Big Eight, lose the Orange Bowl. 9-2 in 1966, win the Big Eight again, lost the Sugar Bowl. Then 66 was T.O.'s first year as a full-time assistant. So it's kind of an interesting twist of fate. He's sort of part of this staff as a graduate assistant. They're going gangbusters. They're winning the conference every year. Devaney's got this thing humming. His first year, they win the conference again. And then things get a little rocky for the boys in red. So in 1967, they go 6-4, 3-4 in conference. That's good for a fifth place finish in the Big Eight, and no bowl game for the first time in Devaney's tenure. They also averaged 20 points per game less than the year before. So in 1968, it doesn't get much better. They go 6-4 again, 3-4 in conference again. They tied for a fourth place finish in the Big Eight. Again, there's no bowl game for the second consecutive season. Reminder, there were a lot fewer bowl games back then, and the criteria for getting to a bowl game was much higher.
Yeah, and if you actually dig into the numbers, 68 wasn't just not much better. It was worse. It was way worse, because what happened was in 67, they kind of lost a lot of close games. And so people kind of gave Devaney a little bit of a pass in that year. It's like, yeah, that'll happen. You know, they lost a lot of one score games. And then 68 came along, and it was dreadful. The offense was abysmal. They, in both seasons, they went 3-4 in the Big Eight. So they actually had losing records in the Big Eight in both seasons. But in 68, they actually lost at home to Kansas State, which had not won a conference game in four seasons. Oof. And they lost at home to that team 12-0. They got shut out at home, and it was their third straight home loss. I can't even remember if Scott Frost ever achieved that, but
probably.
but it had not going. I know it had not. It had not at the time I wrote my book. It had not happened since, where they had lost three consecutive home games, and then they went to Oklahoma, and absolutely got shellacked, 47-0. And Bobby Owens set a Big Eight touchdown record against them. So they weren't very good defensively either, but they didn't score a single point against the Sooners. And all of a sudden, it wasn't just like, we can give Devaney a pass for this. He was in hot water at that moment.
So that's what I'd love to pivot to that a little bit. We all know Husker fans are the best in the nation, but we have high expectations. So it's kind of curious to me at that point, there had been a whole lot of losing for a long time. And then Devaney just completely flipped the script and won several conference titles in a row. You would think maybe that would buy him a little more good grace, I guess, for lack of a better way of putting it. But what's the mood like in Husker Nation after that 1968 season?
Well, you know, fans like Bob. You know, he was kind of a gregarious guy, and he was really popular at the Touchdown Club, and he was always joking a lot. But he found that the fans don't laugh at your jokes as much when you go 3-4 in the Big Eight. And you know, the rumors are, let's say the legend is that there were petitions circulated in Omaha to fire Devaney as coach. Now, I've looked into that, and there were no press reports at the time of a petition. And I even talked to the guy who was the head of the Touchdown Club. And he said, you know, if there was an effort like that, it was pretty feeble because I was not aware of it. But it wasn't until more than a decade later that Tom and some others talked about this petition that was out there. So if it was, it was never very high profile and it never got off the ground. But no, there's no question. Devaney knew that this could not continue. And he and his coaches, including Tom, that, you know, they basically decided they needed to completely overhaul everything they were doing at that point. And it was a really turning point moment because there were three really critical things that they did. And one was, for the first time, Devaney hired an offensive coordinator and defensive coordinator. For the first time, they started off-season conditioning. And for the first time, they stepped up their recruiting game and they started going coast to coast to try to get talent.
Well, so let's elaborate on that with the coaching changes. It was also that year, so he made Tom Osborne offensive coordinator, and something of note, he made Monty Kiffin defensive coordinator. Most football fans know Monty Kiffin. Both, you know, pretty young assistants at the time. But for Osborne in the offense, you know, what did that really entail for him? Was it a complete like scheme change, and you know, the play type of plays that they were running? Or did it, was it, you know, him calling the plays, or what was his role, I guess, beginning at, you know, in that season?
Yeah, no, that's fascinating. Well, first of all, think about this. So he decides to name an offensive coordinator and defensive coordinator. This is, again, the genius of Devaney. I mean, if nothing else, the guy had an eye for talent, because he named the two youngest coaches on his staff as the offensive coordinator and defensive coordinator. And he passed over the guys who had been with him back since Wyoming days to do that. And when you think about it, how remarkable it was that these guys were junior assistants on his staff. I mean, we're talking about one of the greatest defensive minds of all time who would go on to win a Super Bowl and the Tampa 2 defense. And, mm-hmm. you know, he would yeah. change the NFL with his schemes. And you have Tom Osborne, who was an absolute, you know, would go down as one of the greatest offensive minds in history. And they were already on Devaney's staff, probably completely unknown to anybody outside of Lincoln, Nebraska. And so it's completely remarkable. And no, he gave Tom carte blanche on the offense and what he was going to do. And Tom, at the time under Devaney, they were kind of running a power running game. It was really kind of an odd. They ran something called the, and I'm not an X's and O's guys, but Tom at least explained this to me. They ran something called an unbalanced line, where they actually, instead of having a tackle on each side, they put both tackles over on one side. And there wasn't a lot of trickery to it. It was pretty much wherever the two tackles were, that's the side they were going to run to. It was a complete power game and running game. And I mean, they did do some passing, but they were pretty ground pounding attack. And Tom did research. They spent a lot of time looking at Oklahoma and what Oklahoma was doing. They weren't running the wishbone yet. They were, I think, an I team, and they spent a lot of time studying USC, which was running the I. In fact, the same day that they were getting thrashed by Oklahoma, O.J. Simpson was out of the USC I was winning the Heisman Trophy. So
The juice was on the loose.
Yeah, exactly. And so Tom, he went with the eye, but it was his own, again, very creative mind. Rather than having two split ends, he created the position of the wingback. And the wingback would instead be kind of offset, kind of inside the end on one side. And he would be kind of a combination running back and receiver. They could run inside running plays with him, or they could send him out for a pass. And that was a total Tom Osborne in his own innovation on the I formation. And then the other thing that he did was audibles. Every play in the offense that Tom came up with had an audible to something else. And the audible might just switch the side the play was going to run, or it might be a completely different play, but it would be out of kind of the same formation. And it became the quarterback's job to go to the line, look at what the defense was in, because if you ran if you run a play into the wrong defensive formation, it's going to be dead from the very beginning. And so Tom, very innovative. And I don't know where he got the idea. I'm sure he didn't invent the audible, but his offense concluded in a whole audible system. And that was the other key part of it. And it just led to this tremendous transformation of the offense. I mean, you have to remember they went 6-4 one year. 2 years later, they're reaching the ball over the goal line for a national championship. And I mean, it was the turnaround of the offense was just, and really the whole team was just incredible.
Brandon, anything to add to that offensive conversation?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really remarkable. Like Henry did a good job describing it, but like that Devaney offense that came with them from Wyoming was effectively also had a full house backfield. Like it was just forced drama. Like, and it worked. They were ninth nationally in rushing. In 1962, in year two, they led the country in rushing. I think they were top 10 his first 4 years. And then you get into like the 6-4 stretch. And like, so here's the difference that Osborne makes in 69. All those previous Devaney Nebraska teams had been about 75 to 80% run. They're at 64% in 69. And the I formation at that time it had been around for a while, but it's like the predominant offense in the NFL. It's modern, essentially. And the thing that's interesting from a broader perspective is like in the late 60s there, what's bubbling up from places elsewhere is Bill Yeoman at Houston with the veer option. Houston has a ton of success with that. So much so that Daryl Royal, who's feeling a little heat, takes his middle linebackers coach, makes him the OC, Emory Ballard, tells him to develop some option looks, spawns the wishbone, which basically lights the college football world on fire for the next decade. Of course, Texas made that switch, made a quarterback switch 2 games into the year and won its next 30 games in a row. Which leads Oklahoma to the wishbone in 1970. They make the switch 4 games in. This number's crazy to me. Barry Switzer's the OC at the time. So 4 games incredible. Into the 1970 season, to the end of the decade, Oklahoma threw the ball 394 times total in a decade. You can do the math on that, or I could just tell you that they ran the ball 7,592 times. Like, that's what the wishbone was. So, you know, kind of the interesting place that Osborne occupies in this is, like, what's coming up is the option football that we associate with, like, the later Osborne era at Nebraska, but that's not what it was early on, and he didn't really get there, you know, until right around 1980 when he had Jeff Quinn as quarterback.
Yeah.
Right. Wow. And I guess we should mention that the other thing that happened in 69, Osborne started calling the plays. And because up until that time, the Devaney did. And but the interesting thing is it was never revealed at the time that Osborne was offensive coordinator and that Kiffin was defensive coordinator. Devaney would not even admit for like 20 years until the early 1990s that Osborne was the offensive coordinator of that team. And I've looked in the clips. The only way you can tell that there was anything new happening with the staff going into 1969 was that only two coaches, because of that bad season they had in 68, only two coaches got raises, and it was Tom Osborne and Monty Kiffin.
That's so fascinating. In More Than Winning, which I've been leafing through, I believe it was written about 1985. He talks about that transition, and it's very vague. And I thought it was just humble Tom Osborne, because he's like, well, I suggested some plays and, you know, made some changes, and Bob signed off on it all. And like, he's very vague, but clearly his boss at the time was athletic director Bob Devaney, and wasn't talking about the promotion yet.
After Devaney passed, he was a little more open in talking about what it had actually transpired there.
Henry, really quick. I know Jeff's got a question, but I don't want to lose sight of what we're going to come back to the strength and conditioning stuff a little bit, but you also mentioned the junior college recruiting. Can you talk about that a minute? And was that new? I mean, clearly it was new for Nebraska. Was that something new? Were not a lot of teams doing that nationally? Or give us some perspective on that.
No, well, it was new for Nebraska, and it's a funny story about how it came about. So Alabama, and I think Brandon mentioned, you know, some of the bowl games they'd lost to Alabama. And, well, those Alabama teams did not have big offensive lines. They had small offensive lines because what Bryant was doing was basically taking guys that were more like fullbacks and linebackers, bulking them up a little bit and turning them into small offensive linemen. And Nebraska just, they were like these little crabs, and they got under, you know, and they were, getting under the skin of the Nebraska linemen. And so Devaney decided, we're going to do that too in 67, 68 timeframe. But what they did was they took their regular offensive linemen and tried to trim them down. And there were articles written in the paper about how much weight the offensive linemen had shed during the off season and stuff. But unfortunately, what Devaney found was that instead of having small, fast linebackers, he had small, fast offensive linemen. He had small, slow ones. And they just got absolutely pushed around in 1968. So they needed offensive line help fast. Well, you also have to understand in 69, freshmen weren't eligible. So you weren't going to find some stud offensive lineman out of high school and be able to bring him in and have him play for you. And nobody could transfer in because they'd have to sit out a year. Their only choice was to go to the JCs to find some offensive linemen. And so Tom went out to California. And again, he was very integral on this. And he recruited Bob Newton out of a junior college in California. And that's a great story, too, because Newton was, you know, California has this great junior college system. I mean, I've had friends that want, you know, you leave high school, you go to junior college. Most people do 2 years of JC and then they transfer to a 4-year school. So the reason Tom went to California, it has a very robust junior college system.
Breaking news coming in from Bet365, and it's no surprise. Same game parlay from Bet365 just keeps getting better.
Well, it's even easier to make a bet. Choose from the most popular markets like hits, run line, totals, and home runs. So many to choose from.
Download the app, start building your bet, and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
And a lot of them played football. But recruiting was nothing like what it was now. There were no recruiting services. Basically, Tom said he just had to show up at the JCs and say, hey, do you have any good players? Did you play against any good players? And show me some film. I mean, he literally was scouting while he was out there in California. And he caught on to this Newton guy. And Newton, as a kid who had grown up in L.A., he wanted to play for USC. He wanted to play for the hometown team. And he was a little bit miffed that that they hadn't offered him a scholarship. They kind of toyed with him a little bit, but in the end, they didn't come through with anything. Well, Tom's big selling point to Newton was, well, I just have to tell you, we're the next 2 years, we're playing USC. he got to play against USC during his 2 years that he played at Nebraska, including, you know, he was a starter on the 1970. He started late in 69, was a full-time starter in 70. And Tom went back-to-back to the JCs. The 70 team had two offensive line starters that were out of JCs. The 71 team had three offensive line starters that came out of JCs, one from Arizona and two from California. So it absolutely was critical to those national championship teams that they did that. And you have to understand, Nebraska was not a nationwide recruiter up to that point. Devaney tended to recruit the Big Ten footprint because that's what he was familiar with. So he got his players largely from Nebraska and then Big Ten states, you know, the Chicago area and Michigan. And but they didn't really go further east in the than maybe Pennsylvania, and they didn't go further west than maybe Wyoming, you know, where he had some roots. And the same time he sent Tom to out to California, he sent Kiffin to New Jersey, and he came back with Rich Glover. So it was, and that was Tom, of course, expanded upon that greatly. But that was the beginning of Nebraska becoming going nationwide in its recruitment, and we know that was a key to the gold, you know, the golden era. That was another one of the keys.
Brandon, anything to add to that? Mm-hmm.
Well, it's interesting because I have a nerdy spreadsheet for recruits by state, starting in 73 when Osborne took over as head coach, and like, you know, we think of Nebraska particularly in the Big 12 era, but a little bit in the Big 8. As, you know, being really, really reliant on Texas, which it was, it had as many recruits from California over that time period. And to hear Henry talk about going out there to look for junior colleges, because you could probably get to four or five a day instead of, you know, there's plenty in Kansas too, but you not so centrally located. You know, just I'm not saying you can draw a one-to-one line between that, but it's just interesting knowing that that's where they went, and California would be absolutely vital to the players who would end up playing for Coach Osborne.
Brandon, can you remember the name of the offensive lineman who played on those championship teams in the 70s who came from New Jersey? I'm blanking on his name.
No, I don't.
Because Monty told me the greatest story about how Devaney when he first sent him out to New Jersey, and he said, I swear to God, Henry, I was at I'm out there and I'm sitting at a Howard Johnson and I'm sitting there with Rich Glover, this offensive lineman's name
is Darryl White.
Yes, Darryl. Yes. So I'm sitting at a Howard Johnson with Rich Glover, Darryl White, and Drew Pearson. And he thought he had all three of them. And of course, two of them went on to become All-Americans. And Drew, of course, became a Hall of Fame NFL player. But Drew ended up, I can't remember what happened, but he lost Drew. I think Drew ended up at Tulsa for some reason. Maybe he couldn't make grades or something. And he ended up at Tulsa, but he thought he was going to get all three of those guys on his first trip to New Jersey.
Hilarious. Henry, the question I have, and we've kind of, you answered a lot of it already, but the one thing it is remarkable that they had both Monty Kiffin and T.O. on staff. Obviously we know where Monty Kiffin went, and T.O. is T.O. You already kind of mentioned a few things, just the I formation, the invention of the wingback, things of that nature, audibles. So I guess really what I'm curious about is the key thing that you brought up was Devaney had an eye for this sort of thing. And you said he hired two of the most younger people on his staff and promoted them up above and beyond some of the older, more experienced people. So I guess what did he see in T.O. that made him decide that he could entrust the entire offense to him? TJ said it. I mean, was he just throwing things out there like, hey, what about this audible thing? What about this wingback thing? Or did you just see something special in him?
I think it just gets back to the genius of Osborne. I mean, there's a reason that, you know, there are just so many stories about Osborne over the years and just what an incredible tactician he was, you know, and who can forget, you know, in the game against Colorado, he told the running back, and again, I'm blanking on the name, the guy went to, played for Green Bay all those years in the NFL.
Green.
Yeah. So he goes to Amon Green, before the Colorado game and says, and he could just tell the way that the exit, he knew the way he thought Colorado was going to line up. And he said to him, I think there's going to be a very good chance that you're going to score on this play. And the very first play, Colorado comes out in the exact formation he thought they would. Nebraska had an extra man on that side, and he went untouched down the sideline for however many yards. I mean, it was like everyone else was playing checkers and he was playing chess. I mean, that is just how good a tactician he was.
Damn right.
There's a Leo Tolstoy quote: chance created the situation, genius made use of it. And it just sort of, I feel like that's
great quote
applicable here. Yeah. Brandon, yeah. Anything to add to that?
I'm also going to read a quote. It's a little bit lengthy, but I've used it all so many times over the years. It's from Homer Smith, born in Omaha, was not a very successful head college football coach, but was coordinator at UCLA, Arizona, Alabama, well-regarded guy. And he said, Tom Osborne understood what made option plays work and what had stopped them. So he ran them. He ran almost all of them. But when they would work, he checked to them versus vulnerable defenses. His smash mouth runs, run action passes, QB runs kept defenses from mirroring properly against his options. The result was staggering totals of rushing yards. No matter how successful the options had been in their individual heydays, they were never better than when Coach Osborne played a medley of tunes. What would stop it? The only thing that would stop Bill Walsh's passing attack, which was the retirement of the man who made it work. End quote.
I love that.
Abusive, but like, I think that is sometimes just like bottom line. That's it. Like, he was just better at it than most other people. And there's a lot of evidence to suggest it beyond just that quote.
And it wasn't just genius. It was, a tireless work ethic that he would spend hours and hours and hours and hours and hours watching film. And, you know, and he just, loved to, he, before a bowl game on Christmas Eve, I once heard a story. They were down on bowl site. It was Christmas Eve. Somebody walked in, he was watching film, and it was really what I think is other underappreciated about Osborne. He was a competitor. You know, he deep down, he was a competitor. He did not like to lose. He obviously lost very gracefully, but he did not like to lose. And it was that fierce competitiveness that was part of that drive that would allow him to spend more hours than anybody else watching film.
Awesome.
I just got to say, Matt, real quick, if you told me a year and a half ago that we'd be quoting Tolstoy on the Common Fan podcast, I would have told you you're a crazy man.
Hey, we all advance and we all evolve, Jeff.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Switching gears here to something that I don't think can be ignored in the whole Tom Osborne saga, but another thing that happened in, you know, that late 60s era was an injured pole vaulter from the Nebraska track team named Boyd Epley was spending a lot of time lifting weights and getting a little bit of a following among the football team. Henry, can you talk about Boyd Epley's role and influence with the team and how that came about, and maybe even specifically how Tom Osborne was the one who was open-minded to this new thing called weight training that most teams weren't doing. And was he kind of the one that helped convince Devaney to let Coach Epley eventually do that, right?
Yes. And I've spoken about that play and Tom about this, and it's absolutely true. So what happened was Epley was a pole vaulter and a good one, and a native Nebraskan, and he I think he had the one of the school records, either indoor or outdoor, but he was having injury problems. And at the time, there was a small weight room inside the stadium that was mostly used by rehabbing athletes. A lot of football coaches did not believe in weightlifting at that time. The idea was it would make you muscle bound and you'd lose your athleticism. So it was just not something that was done. But Boyd, but there were a few football players that did it. And Boyd started lifting weights to rehab for his injuries. And he completely got into bodybuilding. And he loved the look of what it was doing to his body. And so he just became a voracious weightlifter. Well, some of the football players were seeing this and they were like, well, God, I want to look like that guy. And so they start, Boyd said he basically showed up to the weight room one day and there were a bunch of football players there. And they said, we want you to show us how you do that. And he realized at that point they had been kind of watching him. And so he did. He started showing them some of the ropes. Well, Tom got wind of this. And at the time, they had just started off-season conditioning, but it did not really involve weightlifting. One of the things involved was an axe-handled drill that was just like the most brutal. It was like gladiator, pretty much. But it did not. The only weightlifting involved like some pipes with coffee cans of concrete on the end. Very rudimentary weightlifting stuff. They just weren't set up for it. But Tom got wind of this and he phoned Boyd one day and asked him to come over to the football office. And he basically said, I think we'd like you to teach the football team how to lift weights. Offered him $2 an hour, 6 hours a week. So $12 a week to become the first ever strength coach in college football history. And they did have to convince Devaney because he was one of those that was kind of among the skeptics. And in fact, Boyd tells the story that he went into Devaney's office and he's sitting in this big leather chair behind this desk and he's being the skeptic and he wasn't sure that he was going to agree. And he said that at the end, Bob said, okay, we can do it. But if the guys end up getting slower, you're fired.
I love that. You know who else doesn't believe in weight training is Jeff.
That's a lie. You know it.
Brandon, anything to add to that?
I mean, I think it's just another example. And when I was, researching for this show, like there's this notion of, they're called sigmoid leaps. And if you can picture like a classic S curve on a graph, you've got the learning phase, which is the low point, and then you have a growth phase. And the idea is like, okay, you grow and become successful. You got to jump off that curve for the next one before the decline starts. And, I think about this a lot in terms of football. And I think what we have here is evidence of Devaney jumping to, okay, I'm going to get an OC and a DC. And not only that, they're going to be the lowest paid guys on our staff. That's who I'm choosing. That's a leap. And for Nebraska to go into strength and conditioning, what would be another one of those of like, okay, because that's late in the Devaney tenure, relatively speaking, and had some success. Okay, but we're going to make a jump and we're going to bypass the decline phase in hopes of catching another wave on its way up.
Well, TJ, this is directed, and Henry, just so you know, we did have Boyd Epley on early on when the Common Fan podcast first started out, and he is going to sign me up for some weight training. So don't let TJ misinform.
Been over a year, Jeff.
Yeah, that was over a year ago, Jeff. Has that happened yet?
We'll talk about that later. Yeah. I'm sorry, I can hear you. Your mic's cutting out.
Okay.
They were just ahead of their time. I mean, it was just, innovation was just became one of the keys to success. And again, it comes down to Tom Osborne. He's the one who convinced Devaney to do it.
It's awesome. So, Henry, there's a lot of changes taking place after the 1968 season. The Huskers right the ship in 1969, going 9-2 and tying for the Big 8 championship. And it's during this season that Devaney first raises that idea of actually retiring. Can you talk about the famous conversation on the bus ride home after the Kansas State game in 1969?
It was a successful season in 69, but nonetheless, very stressful. It was a very stressful 9-2. It included a win at home against Kansas that was basically a total robbery because there was just a phantom pass interference call that McFarland drew that bailed Nebraska out of a sure defeat. And the game, you know, they lost to Kansas State, that embarrassing loss at home. And then they went to Kansas State, and Kansas State was getting good. At that time, and they just had a battle, and Nebraska ended up pulling it out by a small margin. And so again, success but Devaney, by that time, he's athletic director. So he's wearing two hats and he's beginning to think, God, do I really want to continue to deal with all this stress? And so he called Tom over in the bus and he basically said, "Hey, Tom, I'm not sure how much more of this I want to keep up. I think I'm getting ready to step down, and I'm going to go maybe a year or another year or so. But and when I step down, I want you to replace me." It was a very fateful conversation that we wouldn't learn about for a long time, and in fact, the fact that he didn't put a definite, we haven't even talked about the 70 and 71 yet, but Bob decided after they won the national championship in 70 that, well, maybe football isn't that bad. And so he kind of put off that retirement a couple of times, which was why finally, going into the 72 season, he's won two championships in a row. Every expectation they're going to get a three-peat. And he announces at the start of the season, "This is my last season, and Tom Osborne is going to follow me." But we haven't even talked about 70 and 71 yet, and just what incredible seasons those were.
Yeah. Brandon, anything to add to that?
Nope. That covers it for me.
Well, and so speaking of 70 and 71, as you noted, Henry, certainly winning a couple national titles will make a coach maybe want to keep sticking around for a little bit longer. I think everyone knows the story of those teams, and I kind of want to keep it focused on Osborne. What really jumps out to me more than anything is, and we've kind of talked about a lot of the reasons why, you know, Devaney rightfully deserves credit for all of his success at Nebraska, of course, including the first two national championships in program history. But if you look at, for all the reasons we've discussed over the last almost hour, there's one, Tom Osborne is the center of of everything that really like led to that success, right?
Right, right. Let's say this about Devaney too. Tom Osborne would tell you he learned a lot from Bob Devaney.
Yeah.
Tom was great with players. He would tell you probably that he learned a lot of that from Bob Devaney and how you treat players and how you treat them with respect. And, you know, Bob Devaney was completely colorblind and he was the first, you know, he wasn't the first coach to, recruit African Americans to Nebraska, but he fully embraced anybody who could play for him. And when you look back at those late 60s, you know, those bowl games that they were playing against Alabama and Auburn and LSU in the 1970 championship team, you're talking about segregated teams that were not recruiting African American athletes. So Bob really deserves a lot of credit as the as the architect and as the guy who got it started. And he was very organized. He knew how to run a program, and he recognized talent, and he knew he learned to delegate, and that's a mark of a leader too. And so I think clearly Devaney deserves a lot of credit, and Tom learned a lot from him on the personnel side. But yeah, I mean, there are 5 national championships at Nebraska, and the first one happened 2 years after Tom Osborne totally overhauled the offense, and probably does not happen if that had not occurred. So we know the first national championships happened with him as assistant, that he leaves with, 3 national championships in his last 4 years. And we know the sad story of what's happened since then. I mean, I can make a strong case that the national championship era of Nebraska football can largely be traced to one man, and we know who that is.
Yeah. And if you want to learn about everything that's happened since Tom Osborne retired, you should check out the Reckoning series from the Common Fan Podcast. Brandon, any thoughts on that?
No, I would just echo what Henry said. Like, I think it's quite clear that in terms of coaching, Bob Devaney was a master craftsman. It just, through luck, design, identification, it just so happened that his apprentice was even better, I think, is what we're looking at.
I got one more thing I want to ask you guys about, but any final thoughts on sort of those? We're sort of almost glossing over the 2 national championship teams, but any final thoughts on the 70, 71, and 72 teams? Kind of had it, back to being a well-oiled machine before T.O. would take over as the head man in 1973.
I mean, the thing that jumps out to me is just how well-rounded they were. You know, I mentioned kind of how Nebraska had been really run heavy in the Devaney early years, and Tom Osborne brought more passing to that. After they ranked in the top 10 nationally in rushing in 65, they wouldn't get back there until 77. So that tells you, I think, about like what Nebraska offensively was doing. They'd rank in the top 10 in total offense and scoring offense sometimes. But this was not like the option era that was to come, where it was just basically Nebraska or Oklahoma led the country rushing for, I think, almost 15 straight years, starting around 1980 or something like that. But the 70 and 71 teams, just dynamite defenses too. I mean, just a really like championship teams, and they won the championships. I mean, Rich Glover is one of the greatest players in college football history.
Yeah.
So you paired that with increased offense from Nebraska, and you had something that worked pretty well.
Henry, anything to add to that?
No, not really. The lot of just epic battles there, and I mean the game of the century, just unbelievable. 2 incredible offenses, the Oklahoma wishbone, and the Oklahoma's wishbone was an absolute terror that season. I mean, they were just running roughshod over everybody, and it was a high-scoring game. But Tom Osborne's offense, but let's not forget Johnny Rogers' punt return, I guess. But Tom Osborne's offense, ended up winning the day, and that last drive, Tom is the one who's calling the plays there.
Austin.
Yeah, that 71 Oklahoma team averaged 472 yards a game. Still the NCAA record today. Nebraska held them to 279 on 64 attempts.
Wow. Yeah. So one other thing I want to ask you guys about. So the next episode in this series is going to focus on T.O. getting the head job and that first sort of decade or most of a decade of the 1970s and sort of that era of his coaching career. What I found really interesting in More Than Winning, again, another one all Husker fans should go out and get, is he seemed to have a lot, or this, in retrospect, he had a lot. He talked about having a lot of hesitancy in following Devaney. And he interviewed at South Dakota for the head job in 1968. He interviewed at Texas Tech for the head job in 1969. And it was also like he talked about that conversation on the bus and how it kind of took him off guard. And I don't know if it was, you know, him being humble or that's part of it or what, but seemed to have, you know, he recognized not only Devaney's success, but Devaney's charisma and his likability and all these things. I think all, you know, it's like following anybody. Nobody wants to follow a legend, right? And so I would love to hear you guys talk about that as we kind of pivot to, of course, we all know he does get the head job after Devaney retires. He takes over in 1973. But maybe that wasn't quite as preordained as it's become in the legend. Any thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, I don't know how seriously he did an interview at Texas Tech, and that was after, you know, Devaney had, I think it was after he had already talked to him about the job. So I don't know how seriously he would have considered that, but yeah, no, we, not to skip ahead too much into the 70s, you know, we know in 78, you know, he interviewed at Colorado, and, you know, when he was kind of having his own Bob Devaney moment and his Bob Devaney 1968 moment. And again, I don't think anybody in Nebraska would like to think about what the alternative history would have been had he done that.
No.
Oh, you look disgusted there.
Yeah, I mean, every time I hear about that, I just feel like I want to throw up a little bit in my mouth.
we might be living the alternative history over the past.
Yeah.
No kidding.
No kidding.
Proof.
All right, so I want to wrap up here, guys, because I think it's fitting. And Tio wrote this in More Than Winning, which was in the mid-80s, but it's talking about winning that first national championship. But I think this was applicable throughout his coaching career, and it really struck me. And he talks about they beat Alabama 34-6, and they're on the bus on the way back to the hotel, and the way he kind of talks about almost being like sort of in a stupor. He uses the word stupor, and he's kind of thinking this is supposed to be the epitome of what a person could experience in college football. And then they get back to the hotel and he talks about how they're in the room and Nancy's like bouncing off the wall. She's like, we got to celebrate. We got to do something. And she's like, I'm getting out of here. Like, let's go. And he's just kind of reflecting. And I want to read this quote. It really isn't so much achieving the end result, the national championship and the trophies, which are all fine. But the important thing about athletics really is the process. It's the path you follow in attempting to win the championship that's important. The relationships that are formed, the effort given, the experiences you have. And when it's over, it's all over. Everything else, at least for me, was kind of an anti-climax. I thought that was a really, really fascinating insight into the man. Any reaction to that?
I thought that you were going to quote Socrates, TJ.
Now that's the TO we all know and love.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it really, it gets to the heart of, you know, when you look at his education and I think what we all know of him as a person, like, and Matt Rhule says it all the time now, like he mentions that they are teachers and that's what Tom Osborne was. And he happened, you know, he could have been the more conventional definition of a teacher. He chose to do it in football. And if you take that kind of approach, I think you quickly develop an understanding, at least if you want to keep doing it and be successful, that it is all about the process. And the games, these games flip on 4, 5, 6 plays, you know? There's only so much you can control at the end of the day.
Yeah. No, I mean, it gets to what he, in the end, what coaching was to him, it was literally the process of turning boys to men. And that's what he enjoyed about it. I mean, and he said this late in his career, you know, and he would tell the players, you know, the trophies gather dust, you know, the memories fade, but the character you build is what you carry with you through the rest of your life.
Yeah.
Love that.
And you hear it in the way that a lot of his former players would talk about him. You know, they revered the man, and there's a reason for that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we're Matt, Jeff, all about this series.
That's right. That's exactly right. Much more of that to come. Matt, Jeff, any final thoughts?
No questions. Just that I wanted to thank Henry and Brandon for joining us. They were outstanding.
Thank you both. I really appreciate you giving us just a moment of your time. It's been awesome.
I look forward to listening to the rest of the series, guys.
Well, thank you, Henry. Jeff could use Boyd's number so he could schedule that first weight training workout, if you don't mind. That'd be great. Much thanks to Henry Cordes and Brandon Vogel. This was just an outstanding and thoroughly enjoyable conversation and really great way to kind of kick off this series. So thank you guys both. Really enjoyed having you on.
Yeah, my pleasure.
All right. As mentioned, Common Fans, the next episode in the series will focus on T.O.'s first 7 or 8 years as a head coach in the 1970s. We've got a couple more really exciting guests lined up for that one. And so we'll be back at you with that one next week. In the meantime, as always, GBR for life.
Breaking news, and this one is almost unbelievable.
Yeah, it's all about new customers at Bet365 because they get $150 in bonus bets when they bet $5, win or lose. And even better, bonus bets can be used on the spread, totals, and player props.
There you have it. Bet $5 to get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. And see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. TNCs apply. Available in app only.